Letters pop out from a white background, then turn red. Netflix. A map of the world with the southern part of the USA highlighted.
So let's look at the statistics. The United States is home to 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners.
Black lines trickle down the highlight.
Think about that.
Van Jones.
A little country with 5% of the world's population having 25% of the world's prisoners? One out of four human beings with their hands on bars, shackled, in the world, are locked up here in the land of the free.
A Netflix original documentary.
We had a prison population of 300,000 in 1972. Today we have a prison population of 2.3 million. The United States now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world.
A forward movement can-do production.
So you see now, suddenly there is an awakening that, oh, perhaps we need to downsize our prison system. It's gotten too expensive. It's gotten out of hand. But the very folks who often express so much concern about the cost and the expanse of the system are often very unwilling to talk in any serious way about remedying the harm that has been done.
An Ava DuVernay film.
History is not just stuff that happens by accident. We are the products of the history that our ancestors chose, if we're white. If we are black, we are products of the history that our ancestors most likely did not choose. Yet here we all are together, the products of that set of choices, and we have to understand that in order to escape from it.
In white over black, the Roman numerals XIII.
The 13th Amendment to the Constitution makes it unconstitutional for someone to be held as a slave. In other words, it grants freedom.
The word freedom changes into doves, then stars.
All Americans.
Over the stars and stripes.
There are exceptions, including criminals.
There's a clause, a loophole.
If you have that embedded in the structure, in this constitutional language, then it's there to be used as a tool for whichever purposes one wants to use it.
Section 2 of the amendment contained the sentence, Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Images of convicts, mostly African Americans, in striped uniforms and carrying shovels. The Roman numerals XIII, the 13th. Jelani Cobb, Professor of African American Studies, University of Connecticut.
One of the things that people have to bear in mind is that when we think about slavery, it was an economic system. And the demise of slavery at the end of the Civil War left the Southern economy in tatters. And so this presented a big question. There are 4 million people who were formerly property, and they were formerly kind of the integral part of the economic production system in the South, and now those people are free.
An old photograph of a big family in a cotton field.
And so what do you do with these people?
Adults and children photographed outside a house.
How do you rebuild your economy?
Another photo of a cotton field.
The 13th Amendment loophole was immediately exploited.
After the Civil War, African Americans were arrested en masse. It was our nation's first prison boom.
Michelle Alexander, convicts in stripes at work.
You are basically a slave again. The 13th Amendment says that, hey, except for criminals, everybody else is free. Well, now if you're criminalized, that doesn't apply to you.
They were arrested for extremely minor crimes like loitering or vagrancy.
And they had to provide labor to rebuild the economy of the South after the Civil War.
Henry Louis Gates, Jr., a line of convicts stand by a railway track. Others carry hoes.
What you got after that was a rapid transition to a kind of mythology of black criminality. Go back and, you know, read the rhetoric that people used then. They would say that the Negro is out of control, that there's a threat of violence to white women. So the same sort of image we had of Uncle Remus and these genial kind of black figures was replaced by this rapacious, menacing Negro male evil that had to be banished.
A scene from D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation, adapted from Thomas Dixon's novel, The Klansman.
Birth of a Nation was just a profoundly important cultural event. A
Princess, the first major blockbuster film, hailed for both its artistic achievement and for its political commentary.
And when it was released, it had this rapturous response. You know, there were lines, you know, everywhere that it was being shown.
Birth of a Nation confirmed the story that many whites wanted to tell about the Civil War and its aftermath. To erase defeat and to take out of it sort of a martyrdom. Woodrow Wilson, the sitting president, had a private screening of Birth of a Nation in the White House. He calls it history written with lightning.
And every image you see of a black person is a demeaned, animal-like image. Cannibalistic, animalistic. The image of the African-American male.
A white woman screams.
There's a famous scene where a woman throws herself off a cliff rather than be raped by a black male criminal. In the film, you see black people being a threat to white women.
All the myths of black men as rapists was ultimately stemmed by the reality that the white political elite and the business establishment needed black bodies working.
Five men capture the alleged would-be rapist, a group of hooded men on horseback. A crowd of men, women, and the hooded riders march together.
What we overlook about Birth of a Nation was that it was also a tremendously accurate prediction of the way in which race would operate in the United States.
The trial. The prisoner is dragged before about a half dozen hooded men. Guilty. The horsemen stop at a house. One tosses the prisoner's body onto the porch. The letters KKK are pinned to his shirt.
Birth of a Nation was almost directly responsible for the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan. It had received this romantic, glowing, heroic portrait. The Klan never had the ritual of burning the cross. That was something that D.W. Griffith came up with because he thought that it was a great cinematic image. So it was literally an instance of life imitating art.
The ripples emanate far out from just the simple fact that it's a movie in the early motion picture age.
Jelani Cobb again.
With the tremendous burst of popularity that the Ku Klux Klan had as a result of Birth of a Nation, came another wave of terrorism.
The Jackson Daily News, April 13, 1937. Mob kills two Negroes. One Negro burned, one shot upstairs, third man whipped. A crowd posed beside two bodies hanged by the neck.
We had lynchings in this country between Reconstruction and World War II. Thousands of African Americans are murdered by mobs under the idea that they had done something criminal.
At the National Democratic Convention in New York in 1924, it is estimated that at least 350 delegates were Klansmen.
Demographic geography of this country was shaped by that era. We have African Americans in Los Angeles and Oakland and Chicago and Cleveland, Detroit, Boston, New York, and very few people appreciate that the African Americans in those communities did not go there as immigrants looking for new economic opportunities. They went there as refugees from terror.
We didn't just land in Oakland, in LA, in Compton, in Harlem, in Brownsville in 2015. This is generational trauma.
The letters KKK were carved with a penknife on the chest and stomach of this man in Houston, Texas, after he had been hanged by his knees from an oak tree and flogged with a chain.
The Chicago Negro boy, Emmett Till, is alleged to have paid unwelcome attention to Rory Bryant's most attractive wife.
Various headlines. 3,000 will burn Negro. Negro boy was killed for wolf whistle. Missing Negro boy found shot to death in river. Images of a crowd at a double lynching.
And then when it became unacceptable to engage in that kind of open terrorism, then it shifted to something more legal. Segregation, Jim Crow.
Segregation forever.
Laws were passed that relegated African Americans to a permanent second-class status.
300,000 Negroes are denied vote. A sign, colored only, police order.
These things really begin to live out the prophecy that Griffith was making about the way that race operates. And this fear of crime is central to all of this.
Every time you saw a sign that said white and colored, every time you had to deal with the indignation of being told you can't go through the front door, every day you weren't allowed to vote, every day you weren't allowed to go to school, you were bearing a burden that was injurious.
Brian Stevenson, founder Equal Justice Initiative.
Civil rights activists began to see the necessity of building not just a civil rights movement, but a human rights movement.
And I think we should start now preparing for the inevitable. And let us, when that moment comes, go into the situations that we confront with a great deal of dignity, sanity, and reasonableness.
An African-American man in a suit and hat is kicked and manhandled along a city street by a group of white men.
They want to throw white children and colored children into the melting pot of integration, through out of which will come a conglomerated, mulatto, mongrel class of people. Both races will be destroyed in such a movement.
We just got a report here on this end that the students are in.
Negroes were trying to integrate the bathing beaches, and the Florida Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission warned that the city was becoming a racial super bomb with a short fuse.
Footage of Martin Luther King.
Civil rights activists began to be portrayed in the media and among, you know, many politicians as criminals, people who were deliberately violating the law, segregation laws that existed in the South.
The voice of Martin Luther King.
For years now, I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. Justice too long delayed is justice denied.
I think that one of the most brilliant tactics of the civil rights movement was its transformation of the notion of criminality. Because for the first time, being arrested was a noble thing.
Henry Louis Gates, Harvard University.
Being arrested by white people was your worst nightmare. Still is for many African Americans. So what they did, they voluntarily defined a movement around getting arrested. They turned it on its head.
Teenage African Americans waving to camera as they're locked up.
If you looked at the history of black people's various struggles in this country, the connecting themes is the attempt to be understood as full, complicated human beings.
Placards, I am a man.
We are something other than this visceral image of criminality and menace and threat to which people associate with us.
Police wearing Perspex gas masks line up in rows. Dogs are kept on leads. Water hoses are aimed at nonviolent protesters. One man is dragged away.
We're willing to be beaten for democracy, and you misuse democracy in the street.
Let us lay aside irrelevant differences and make our nation whole.
The late President Lyndon B. Johnson.
The Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, said, finally, we admit it. Though slavery ended in December 1865, we took away these people's rights, and now we're going to fix it.
Mark Maurer.
For the first time, the promise of, you know, equal justice becomes at least a possibility.
Their cause must be our cause, too.
Unfortunately, at the very same time that the civil rights movement was gaining steam, crime rates were beginning to rise in this country.
Crime was increasing, and the baby boom generation that had emerged immediately after World War II, now they were adults. So just through sheer demographic change, we had an increase in the amount of crime.
And became very easy for politicians then to say that the civil rights movement itself was contributing to rising crime rates, and that if we were to give the Negroes their freedom, then we would be repaid as a nation with crime.
A rising graph image.
The prison population in the United States was largely flat throughout most of the 20th century. It didn't go up a lot, it didn't come down a lot. But that changed in the 1970s. And in the 1970s, we began an era which has been defined by this term, mass incarceration.
This is a nation of laws, and as Abraham Lincoln has said, no one is above the law, no one is below the law, and we're going to enforce the law, and Americans should remember that if we're going to have law.
Nina Simone sings.
Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang. Breaking rocks and serving my time. Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang.
A cavalcade moves to the Capitol. A group includes future President Ronald Reagan, Vice President Gerald Ford, and President Nixon.
Each moment in history is a fleeting time.
precious and unique. But some stand out as moments of beginning, in which courses are set that shape decades or centuries. This can be such a moment.
Professor Angela Davis.
It's with the Nixon era and the law and order period when crime begins to stand in for race.
If there is one area where the word war is appropriate, it is in the fight against crime.
Part of what he talked about was a war on crime, but that was one of those code words, what we might call dog whistle politics now, which really was referring to the black political movements of the day, Black Power, Black Panthers, the anti-war movement, the movements for women's liberation and gay liberation at that time, which Nixon felt compelled to fight back against.
Once the federal government, through the FBI, moves into an area, this should be warning to those who engage in these acts that they eventually are going to be apprehended.
There's this outcry for law and order, and Nixon becomes the person who articulates that perfectly.
There can be no progress in America without respect for law.
Many people felt like we were losing control.
We need total war in the United States against the evils that we see in our cities.
A tank on a street.
Federal spending for local law enforcement will double.
Time is running out for the merchants of crime and corruption in American society. The wave of crime is not going to be the wave of the future in the United States of America.
We must wage what I have called total war against public enemy number one in the United States, the problem of dangerous drugs.
A war on drugs, and that utterance gave birth to this era where we decided to deal with drug addiction and drug dependency as a crime issue rather than a health issue. Hundreds of thousands of people were being sent to jails and prisons for simple possession of marijuana, for low-level offenses.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
Jelani Cobb.
This call for law and order becomes integral to something that comes to be known as the Southern Strategy. Nixon begins to recruit Southern whites, formerly staunch Democrats, into the Republican fold.
Persuading poor and working class whites to join the Republican Party in droves.
By speaking to, in subtle and non-racist terms,
a thinly veiled racial appeals.
Talking about crime, by talking about law and order, or the chaos of our urban cities unleashed by the civil rights movement.
We have launched an all-out offensive against crime, against narcotics, against permissiveness in our country.
The rhetoric of get tough and law and order was part and parcel of the backlash of the civil rights movement.
Nixon administration official has admitted that the war on drugs is all about throwing black people in jail. He said, quote, the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did.
The words of John Ehrlichman, chief domestic advisor to Richard Nixon. U.S. prison population in 1970, 3,507,292. By 1980, it had risen to 513,900.
The end of the Reagan era. I'm like level 12, old enough to understand that shit had changed forever. They declared the war on drugs, like a war on terror. But what it really did was let the police terrorize whoever. But mostly black boys, but they would call us niggas and lay us on our belly while they fingers on their triggers.
Reagan's inauguration.
And raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear. I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office.
The election of Ronald Reagan was in many ways transformative in a negative sense.
President Richard Nixon was the first to coin the term a war on drugs, but President Ronald Reagan turned that rhetorical war into a literal one.
It's back to school time for America's children, and while drug and alcohol abuse cuts across all generations,
It's especially damaging to the young people on whom our future depends.
The modern war on drugs was declared by Ronald Reagan in 1982.
As we mobilize for this national crusade, I'm mindful that drugs are a constant temptation for millions.
Popular opinion polls of the day show that it wasn't an issue for most people in the United States. But Reagan was determined to put this onto the agenda to define it as a problem.
The war against drugs is a war of individual battles.
Reagan used his wife, for example, in this Just Say No campaign.
She has helped so many of our young people to say no to drugs. Nancy, much credit belongs to you.
This is your brain. This is drugs.
An actor holds an egg, the brain. He cracks it into a frying pan, the drugs, and shows it to camera.
This is your brain on drugs.
I joined it. And some people say, well, how can you join the person that cleared the war on drugs, or someone like Ronald Reagan? Well, I joined with Nancy Reagan because she said, just say no.
Just say no so loud that everyone around you can hear.
We're talking about a general education that we're talking about. We're not talking about locking up people. We're talking about educating people. We're talking about prevention.
There was a crisis in the U.S. economy at that time.
I regret to say that we're in the worst economic mess since the Great Depression.
There is a frontal assault on institutions that are designed to assist human beings on the education system, welfare, on jobs, health care.
Government programs that can't be paid for out of a balanced budget must be paid for out of your pocket.
They're saying the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer.
The idea of expanding the freedom of American business and the entrepreneurial class.
We will save $1.8 billion in fiscal year 1982.
Luxury stores like Neiman Marcus predicts record sales.
The number of Americans dipping under the poverty level has reached the highest rate in two decades.
Yes, there has been an increase in poverty, but it is a lower rate of increase than it was in the preceding years before we got here. It has begun to decline, but it is still going up.
In the mid-1980s, we're already starting to embark on a war on drugs, and then all of a sudden along comes this new drug, crack cocaine.
Steve Young reports on a new kind of cocaine called crack.
It's dangerous, it's deadly, it will kill you.
The drug epidemic is as dangerous as any terrorist that we face. That is just some of what was said today to House and Senate committees holding hearings on drug abuse in America.
We had this drug that could be marketed in very small doses, relatively inexpensively. This was going to just take over communities, and particularly African-American communities.
Crack was largely an inner city issue, and cocaine was largely a suburban issue.
Smokable cocaine, otherwise known as crack. It is an uncontrolled fire.
Congress, in virtually record time, established mandatory sentencing penalties for crack that were far harsher than those for powder cocaine.
The same amount of time in prison for 1 ounce of crack cocaine that you get for 100 ounces of powder cocaine.
Police here are cracking down on crack dealers.
Usually black or Hispanic, Latino, they were getting long sentences for possession of crack.
You're black with crack cocaine, you're going to prison for basically the rest of your life. And if you're white, you're pretty much getting slapped on the wrist.
Cocaine was more sophisticated. It was just a powder.
By next year, our spending for drug law enforcement will have more than tripled from its 1981 levels.
Pictures of a police raid.
All of a sudden, a scythe went through our black communities, literally cutting off men from their families, literally huge chunks just disappearing into our prisons, and for really long times.
Millions of dollars will be allocated for prison and jail facilities.
You know, these sorts of disparities under Reagan quickly exploded into the era of mass incarceration.
What Reagan ultimately does is takes the problem of economic inequality, of hypersegregation in America's cities, and the problem of drug abuse, and criminalizes all of that in the form of the war on drugs.
We absolutely should have treated crack and cocaine as exactly the same thing. I think it was an enormous a burden on the black community, but it also fundamentally violated a sense of core fairness.
When crack cocaine hit in the early 80s, there are a lot of mayors and so on who felt very strongly that this is a real threat and they wanted to crack down on it. And Rangel was one of the guys pushing for stronger sentencing.
it may have seemed like a good idea at the time, but it sure didn't work out as being effective.
Then years later, there was an effort to rewrite history that it was a racial disparity put in by being white people. It's not where it came from.
In many ways, the so-called war on drugs was a war on communities of color, a war on black communities, a war on Latino communities.
And you see a rhetorical war that was, you know, announced as part of a political strategy by Richard Nixon, and which morphed into a literal war by Ronald Reagan, turning in to something that began to feel nearly genocidal in many poor communities of color.
So Nixon's Southern strategy was implemented right after the Civil Rights Movement. He played on fear of crime and law and order to win the election easily.
Nixon at the Republican convention.
Reagan promised tax cuts to the rich and to throw all the crack users in jail, both of which devastated communities of color, but were effective in getting the Southern vote.
Reagan applauded after a Congress speech.
There's really no understanding of our American political culture without race at the center of it.
And in 1981, just before Reagan assumed the presidency, his campaign strategist, Lee Atwater, was caught on tape explaining the Southern strategy.
In other words, you start out, and now y'all aren't quoting me.
Y'all don't quote me on this.
You start out in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you can't say nigger. That hurts your backfire. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you get it so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than white.
The U.S. prison population in 1980 was 513,900. By 1985, it had risen to 759,100. Public Enemy, don't believe the hype.
Some people never know. The enemy could be their friend guardian. I'm not a hooligan, I rock the party. And the minute they see me, fear me, I'm the epitome of public enemy. Used, abused, without clues, I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
Newspaper headlines: Wilding teens held in rape. Seven are called part of wolf pack.
The war on drugs had become part of our popular culture in television programs like Cops.
All those arrested are black.
When you cut on your local news at night, you see black men being paraded across the screen in handcuffs.
Black people, black men and black people in general, are overrepresented in news as criminals. When I say overrepresented, that means they are shown as criminals more times than is accurate that they are actually criminals, right? Based on FBI statistics.
I mean, I'm a big believer in the power of media full of these cliches that basically present mostly black and brown folks who seem like animals in cages. And then someone could turn off the TV thinking, it's a good thing for prisons, because otherwise those crazy people would be walking on my block.
Creating a context where people are afraid. And when you make people afraid, you can always justify putting people in a garbage can.
Chances are you could run into a kid waiting to relieve you of your purse or wallet.
Every media outlet in the country thinks I'm less than human. I began to hear the word super predator as if that was my name.
Super predator.
Predator.
Super predator.
Super predators. End quote. That's the word they use to describe this generation, and it was very, very effective.
Experts call them super predators.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy.
Group of kids who are growing up essentially fatherless, godless, and jobless.
For me, what's more disturbing is the degree to which black people bought into that.
Animals, beasts that needed to be controlled.
When those grandmothers say, but he's a good boy, he never did anything, don't you believe it?
Many black communities began to actually support policies that criminalize their own children.
Last night, the 18s accused in the attack were arraigned on charges of rape and attempted murder.
In the Central Park Jagger case, they put five innocent teens in prison because the public pressure to lock up these quote-unquote animals was so strong.
You better believe that I hate the people that took this girl and raped her brutally.
You better believe it.
Donald Trump wanted to give these kids a death penalty, and he took out a full-page ad to put the pressure on. These children, four of them under 18, all went to adult prisons for 6 to 11 years before DNA evidence proved they were all innocent.
We make them their crime. That's how we introduce them. Well, that's a rapist. That's a murderer. That's a robber. That's a sex offender. That's a burglar. That's a gang leader. And through that lens, it becomes so much easier to accept that they're guilty and that they should go to prison.
The objective reality is that virtually no one who is white understands the challenge of being black in America.
So you have then educated a public deliberately over years, over decades, to believe that black men in particular and black people in general are criminals. I want to be clear, because I'm not just saying that white people believe this, right? Black people also believe this and are terrified of our own selves.
Do you want to go back to the days of military weakness, caring more about criminals than victims? We can't risk that. I'd like your vote on Tuesday.
Leadership that's on your side. Michael Dukakis for president.
In the midst of the presidential campaign, an ad was released about a person by the name of Willie Horton.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton.
This became a focal point of an entire presidential campaign.
Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
Dukakis had protected the program, vetoed an effort to repeal it, and that he favored letting murderers out on the weekend.
That Dukakis had a double-digit lead over Bush before the campaign focused on Willie Horton, and after that, Bush overtook Dukakis and won the election.
Which candidate for president can you really count on to be tough on crime? George Bush.
Bush won the election by creating fear around black men as criminal without saying that's what he was doing.
A very racially, divisive moment, depicting an African-American criminal, I think, was deliberate on the part of that campaign. You know, there's no one who could tell me otherwise.
Liberals call him Willie Horton to make it sound like you're being dismissive. Original article was Reader's Digest. William Horton, no picture. The Democrats, the ones you know, is black.
Grover Norquist.
Thanks, Grover.
Van Jones.
It was not his name. It was his image that was sensationalized.
Liberals that announced that it was mean to pick on a murderer and a rapist lose all credibility on this discussion. They just lose it. And people go, we don't want to hear anything else you have to say about crime.
No matter what anybody says, what anybody does, they know exactly what button they were trying to hit with that ad.
Stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend.
It went to a kind of primitive fear, a primitive American fear, because Willie Horton was metaphorically the black male rapist that had been a staple of the white imagination since the time just after slavery.
Scenes from the Birth of a Nation.
Here was a black man convicted of rape. I will be the savior and protector of the white population, never minding the fact that the history of interracial rape in this country, that record is far more marked by white rape against black women than of black men against white women.
A bearded white man lies on top of a black woman, 12 years a slave, Steve McQueen. He stops writhing and sits up, facing the woman. Then slaps her face.
This idea that had such great artistic utility in 1915 in Birth of a Nation still had a great deal of political utility almost at the end of that century.
The way that we appeal to voters' sense of fear and anxiety in our nation runs through black bodies.
U.S. prison population 1985, 759,100. By 1990, the prison population had grown to 1,179,200. Dead press with behind enemy lines.
Yo, little Khadija pops his lock. She wanna pop the lock, but prison ain't nothing but a private stock. And she be dreaming about his date of release. She hate the police, but loved by her grandma who hugs and kisses her. Her father's a political prisoner, free Fred. Son of a panther that the government shot dead. Behind enemy lines, my niggas are cellmates. Most of the youth never escape the jail fate. Super maximum camps will advance their game plan to keep us in the hands of the man locked up.
There are a new generation of Democrats, Bill Clinton and Al Gore. And they don't think the way the old Democratic Party did. They've sent a strong signal to criminals by supporting the death penalty.
Looking at the way in which Democrats were defeated in 1988, that they were defeated in 1984, that they were defeated in 1980, there comes to be a sentiment among the Democrats that they have to adopt a position that is much more kind of centrist.
It became virtually impossible for a politician to run and appear soft on crime.
I was not for the bill that he was talking about because it was not tough enough on the criminal.
You know, when you're in an environment where everybody's trying to do the same thing, everybody's competing to be tough on crime, you quickly all end up in the same space, so it doesn't become a political advantage unless you do something more.
We need more police on the street. There is a crime bill which would put more police on the street, which was killed for this session by a filibuster in the Senate, mostly by Republican senators.
We had consistently had squishy, soft liberal won't protect you, tough conservative will protect you, and we won that fight every time. And by the late 80s, early 90s, people like Bill Clinton had begun to figure out they had to be able to match us.
I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Bill Clinton is trying to figure out how he can deal with a country that's still basically Reagan's country, but he's trying to govern as a Democrat.
Violent crime and the fear it provokes are crippling our society.
Then some high-profile, very horrendous crimes take place.
Residents pulled together in the search for 12-year-old Polly Klass. They're now coping with the discovery of her body over the weekend.
Polly Klass abducted from her bedroom at home and ultimately killed, which led to the California three strikes and you're outlaw.
When you commit a third violent crime, you will be put away and put away for good. Three strikes and you are out.
A person is convicted of their third felony. Essentially, that person is mandated to prison for the rest of their lives.
So many third strike defendants awaiting trial, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department is forced to release 4,200 misdemeanor inmates every month to make room for incoming three strike prisoners.
And it's in line with many of the other policies we've created, particularly mandatory minimums.
Mandatory sentencing. We said we were no longer going to let judges consider the circumstances around a crime. We're just going to impose a mandatory sentence.
And that's a difficult thing for judges because they are trying to dispense justice on a daily basis and are unable to do so.
In many California communities, all civil trials have been canceled to catch up with the criminal case workload.
We've taken discretion away from judges, arguably the most neutral party in the court, and given it over to prosecutors.
95% of the elected prosecutors throughout the United States are white.
Serious, violent criminals serve at least 85% of their sentence.
We passed a truth in sentencing law that kept people in prison for 85% of their sentence.
Truth in sentencing. The idea is you're sentenced to a certain amount of time. The public wants to be confident that you're going to do just about every bit of that time.
We've done away with parole. So when you get in the federal system, you get 20 years or 30 years, that's what you got.
We had parole in this country as a mechanism for getting people out of jails and prisons when it was clear that they were no longer a threat to public safety.
Sharonda has spent the last 16 years in prison, and she'll die there because she was sentenced to life without parole. Her only crime, transporting cocaine. And when I say only crime, I mean only crime. She had no other arrests, none. The judge was required to send Sharonda away for life.
Longer sentences, three strikes and you're out. Almost 60 new capital punishment offenses.
And then comes to Congress with a proposal for a $30 billion federal crime bill of 1994 that was heavily loaded towards law enforcement incarceration.
I propose a 21st century crime bill.
to deploy the latest technologies and tactics to make our communities even safer.
That omnibus crime bill was responsible for a massive expansion of the prison system. And beyond that, it provided all kinds of money and perverse incentives for law enforcement to do a lot of the things that we nowadays consider to be abusive.
It will be used to build prisons to keep 100,000 violent criminals off the street.
Not only does he increase funding to states to build prisons, to lock up as many people involved in drug crimes, but also to put 100,000 police officers on the street.
Crime has been a hot political issue, used too often to divide us.
What President Clinton did in 1994 is actually far more harmful than his predecessors, because he actually built that infrastructure that we see today, the militarization, all the way down to small rural police departments that have SWAT teams.
And again, we see this kind of notching up the number of people who are being arrested at every level, and this kind of exploding prison population.
A packed, huge dormitory.
We are a nation that professes freedom, yet we have this mass incarceration, this hyper-incarceration that is trawling into it, grinding into it, our most vulnerable citizenry, and is overwhelmingly biased towards people of color.
U.S. prison population 1990, 1,179,200. In 2000, it was 2,015,300.
But I want to say a few words about it, because I signed a bill that made the problem worse, and I want to admit it.
His 1994 crime bill, something that he now admits was a mistake.
There were longer sentences, and most of these people are in prison under state law, but the federal law set a trend. And that was overdone. We were wrong about that.
Well, I think it's important that President Clinton acknowledges that things didn't turn out exactly as he and all of us would have wished.
I'm happy that he realizes the error of his ways. I think he knew back then that it wasn't good policy, I'll be honest.
Back then, there was an outcry over the rising crime rate, and people from all communities were asking that action be taken. Now, my husband said at the NAACP last summer that it solved some problems, but it created other problems, and I agree.
I'm glad to see that he is apologetic, but I think he has to take responsibility and accountability for that. And so does Hillary, because she supported it then and up until recently.
Bill Clinton faced off against a group of Black Lives Matter protesters protesting a 1994 crime bill that they say led to a surge in the imprisonment of Black people.
I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out onto the street to murder other African-American children. Maybe you thought they were good citizens. She didn't. She didn't. You are defending the people who kill the lives you say matter. Tell the truth.
We can't ignore the reality of force here. The policies that Bill Clinton put forward, you know, mandatory minimums, three strikes, those were a use of political force. They forced millions of people who would not otherwise be in prison today into prison. They forced families to be broken. They forced children to live without their parents. That's what happened.
In 2001, African American U.S. prison population 878,400.
Why?
Van Jones again.
We shouldn't ask, why is Bill Clinton so strong? We should ask, why is the Black community so weak? In our inability to defend ourselves. Let's not forget how many martyrs we put in the ground in the 60s and 70s. Let's not forget how many of our leaders had to leave the country or are in prison. You've stripped out a whole generation of leadership. You ran them out the country, you put them in prison, you put them in cemeteries, and then you unleash this blitzkrieg, and we don't have the ability to defend ourselves. You can tell the story of white leadership in America and never mention the FBI one time. You can't tell the story of Black leadership, not one, without having to deal with the full weight of the criminal justice system weaponized against black dissent.
I'm tired of living every day under the threat of death. I have no martyr complex. I want to live as long as anybody in this building tonight.
Dr. King, people forget, was not this beloved figure that everybody wants to put on a pedestal. He was considered one of the most dangerous people in America by the head of the Federal Bureau of Investigations.
Hoover called him a notorious liar.
Don't tell me that Dr. King has no relevance to the young brothers in the street. They deal with little bitty cops. He was dealing with the top cop.
We were brought here against our will. We were not brought here to be made citizens. We were not brought here to enjoy the constitutional gifts that they speak so beautifully about.
Malcolm's whole entourage was infiltrated with police. He may have had as many police in his entourage as he had regular folk in his entourage, undercover, so afraid of black dissent.
FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover today asserted that the Black Panthers represent the greatest internal threat to the nation.
J. Edgar Hoover said, these Panthers represent the greatest threat to American democracy at the time.
Henry Louis Gates.
The Panthers never were that big. I mean, no one in their right mind could ever believe that the Black Panthers were going to bring down the greatest military force in the history of the world. The whole movement was criminalized and destroyed systematically by the government.
I think people haven't thought about what it means to lose a Fred Hampton, who somehow was able to pull together blacks and whites and Puerto Ricans and Native Americans to fight for justice at 21.
We're going to say it after this, not that I'm locked up, not that everybody's locked up, that you can jail revolutionaries, but you can't jail a revolution.
He had to go.
The head of the Black Panthers in Illinois was killed today by police in Chicago.
Illinois Panther Chairman Fred Hampton and another Panther leader from Peoria, Illinois, were killed.
This is where our chairman had his brain blown out. He lay in his bed, sleeping at 4:30 in the morning.
They literally went and shot his whole house up with his pregnant wife next to him in the bed. So afraid of a leader that could unite people.
We know the history of folks who've done this kind of standing up to these systems, and we know how the system has murdered them, assassinated them, exiled them, excluded them, or found ways to discredit them.
Assad Shakur was one of the great leaders of the Black Liberation Army.
That order given by J. Edgar Hoover was essentially to destroy any black progressive third world movement in this country.
They put her in prison, and her allies said, we're not gonna leave her in prison. She had white allies that said, we're not gonna leave her in prison, and pulled her out of prison and got her to Cuba. She's in Cuba right now.
In the next 5 years, something like 300 prisons are in the planning stages, and this government has the intentions of throwing more and more people in prison.
The criminalization of Assata Shakur, the use of the media to represent her as a dangerous criminal. And of course, in my own case, where I was represented by the FBI as being armed and dangerous.
The FBI has put black militant Angela Davis on its list of the 10 most wanted fugitives.
With Angela Davis, the power of the black intellect.
One of the things that we really have to talk about coming to Christmas is the whole question of crime. What does it mean to be a criminal in this society?
That had to be broken up.
And in my case, Ronald Reagan was the governor of California. Richard Nixon was the president of the U.S. The whole apparatus of the state was set up against me. And they really meant to send me to the death chamber in order to make a point.
The actions of the FBI in apprehending Angela Davis, a rather remarkable story again.
The system tried to put the sister on trial, and the sister said, no, we're putting you on trial.
Archive footage of Angela Davis's trial.
Comes in the big afro. She didn't go press her hair. She was facing major time. You know, most people, they'd have got a nice little press. You know what I mean? They'd have been there with little white gloves on praying to Jesus. She came in like this. And she devastated the prosecution and walked out of there free.
Angela walks out, smiling.
But the question is, Monica, how did you get there? Did you get there by confrontation, violence?
Oh, is that the question you were asking?
Yeah.
So I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama.
After the four young girls who lived, one of them lived next door to me. I was very good friends with the sister of another one. My sister was very good friends with all three of them. My mother taught one of them in her class. And they went down, and what did they find? They found limbs and heads strewn all over the place. I remember from the time I was very small, I remember the sounds of bombs exploding across the street, our house shaking. I remember my father having to have guns at his disposal at all times because of the fact that at any moment, we might expect to be attacked. I mean, that's why when someone asked me about violence, I just find it incredible. What it means is that the person who's asking that question has absolutely no idea what black people have gone through, what black people have experienced in this country since the time the first black person was kidnapped from the shores of Africa.
And when you strip out a whole generation of leadership, running folk out the country, killing folk, framing folk, you will be vulnerable to Bill Clinton or anybody else. They'll do to you what they will.
The graph of the U.S. prison population from 1970 rises in five-year gaps to 2014 and stands at 2,306,200 inmates. The voice of Lawrence Brownlee, as a man going around taking names.
There's a man going round taking names. He has taken my father's name, and it's left my heart in pain. There's a man going round taking names, going round.
A photograph of a clean-cut black teenager wearing a hoodie with the hood up.
An armed neighborhood watch leader saw Martin walking inside a gated subdivision near Orlando. He thought the 17-year-old looked suspicious.
He's got his hand in his waistband. And he's a black male. God,
these assholes, they always get away.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right,
what is your... Tonight, a deadly shooting in Sanford. Police have the gun, they've got the shooter, but they have not arrested him.
George Zimmerman, armed with a gun, followed this quote-unquote suspicious kid after the dispatcher told him not to. They ended up on the ground in a fight, and George Zimmerman shot and killed Trayvon Martin.
A photograph of Trayvon in a red T-shirt.
The police could not arrest Zimmerman because of this Florida law called Stand Your Ground, which says you can kill someone if you feel threatened, even though it was Zimmerman who had pursued Martin throughout the neighborhood with a gun.
Mr. Zimmerman felt that he, in self-defense, needed to fire his weapon.
Not only was he not arrested after the killing, but in court, Zimmerman actually pleaded self-defense and got off under the Stand Your Ground law.
We, the jury, find George Zimmerman not guilty.
The Stand Your Ground law that was passed in Florida played a huge role in the Trayvon Martin tragedy, and this really ignited the movement that we see today.
A Fight for Justice placard with his photo.
In the wake of Trayvon Martin's death, Florida's Stand Your Ground law came into the spotlight.
How did this law not only get in place in Florida, but around the country? And all the fingers kept pointing back to Alec.
American Legislative Exchange Council.
Alec sounds like the name of a high school lacrosse player who just got baked and wrecked his dad's Saab. But incredibly, it's actually even worse.
Alec is a political lobbying group.
Alec is a political lobbying group.
They write laws.
They write laws.
And give them to Republicans.
And give them to Republicans.
Stand Your Ground.
Stand Your Ground.
Was written by Alec.
Was written by Alec.
ALEC is this private club, and its members are politicians and corporations. But the real question is, should politicians and corporations be in the same private club? Under the umbrella of ALEC, corporate members get to propose laws to their political counterparts, most of whom are Republicans. So through ALEC, corporations have a huge say in our lawmaking. And at ALEC task force meetings, corporate lobbyists secretly vote as equals with lawmakers on bills that those lawmakers then introduce to become laws in our states.
John Oliver.
ALEC is everywhere. Roughly one in four state legislators are members.
And I am proud to stand with ALEC today.
And it's not hard to see why. ALEC makes their jobs troublingly easy. Here's their model electricity freedom bill, which at one point says, be it therefore enacted that the state of insert state repeals the renewable energy mandate. So as long as you can remember and spell the name of your state, you can introduce legislation.
We've also seen ALEC bills introduced where a lawmaker forgot to take the ALEC letterhead off the bill without remembering to take off the ALEC letterhead to try to distance the real role of ALEC and ALEC corporations from those bills.
I'm just curious, does the legislation have some connection to ALEC?
Representative Atkins, I'm not sure why we're pursuing this course of questioning. This bill is my bill. It's not ALEC's bill.
The reason I ask is because earlier you passed out a handout that says Gottwalt at the top, and it says Healthcare Compact, and there's a logo right in the middle of that page. And I went to the ALEC website, and there's exactly the same font, the same size, and the same logo. I mean, literally, it's verbatim.
It's totally shocking to know that ALEC has been around for more than four decades now. It's even more startling to see how it began.
ALEC has forged a unique partnership between state legislators and leaders from the corporate and business community.
Corporations have been influencing laws for decades now through ALEC.
They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Nearly every ALEC bill benefits one of its corporate funders.
A dozen names are identified.
The corporation Walmart was a long-standing member of ALEC at the time that it adopted the so-called Stand Your Ground law. It's a law that created an atmosphere where gun sales boomed. Walmart is the biggest seller of long guns in the U.S., has been the largest retailer of bullets in the world. So it's reasonable to think that Walmart benefited from these Stand Your Ground laws that ALEC pushed that initially prevented the arrest of the killer of Trayvon Martin and was designed to prevent the arrest, prosecution, and conviction of the killer of Trayvon Martin, including through changing the jury instructions to require that a jury be told that someone like George Zimmerman has a right to stand his ground, but not that someone like Trayvon Martin has a right to stand his ground against someone like George Zimmerman with a gun assailing him.
Placards, Obama is Trayvon Martin. God, we need you for justice.
After the outcry over Stand Your Ground and the Trayvon Martin tragedy, Walmart stepped out of ALEC. It left ALEC, abandoned ALEC. But the Walmart family continues to fund ALEC. Other corporations followed suit and stepped away from ALEC, but many corporations are still members, including Koch Industries, State Farm Insurance, Pharma, which is the lobbying group for the pharmaceutical industry. ALEC has been supported by the tobacco industry, as well as AT&T and Verizon. And for nearly two decades, one of those corporations was Corrections Corporation of America.
Every day we serve our communities, from small towns to large cities at more than 60 locations across our country. As the nation's fifth largest correctional system, we build, own, and manage secure correctional facilities.
CCA was the first private prison corporation in the U.S. It started as a small company in Tennessee in 1983.
These folks started making contracts with states, and they had to protect their investments, so the states were required to keep these prisons filled, even if nobody was committing a crime. And in the late 80s and early 90s, this became a growth industry, unlike very few growth industries in America's history. It was absolutely a model guaranteed to succeed.
And one of the ways we see that is through the role of CCA within ALEC to advance a series of bills.
All the legislation you could think of that we fight so hard against, three strikes, you're out.
Three strikes and you are out.
Mandatory minimum sentencing laws.
Serve at least 85% of their sentence.
We're the ones they were putting out there, like on a premier prefix dinner menu, a steady influx of bodies to generate the profit that would go to the shareholders.
Through ALEC, CCA became the leader in private prisons. It's a multi-billion dollar business today that gets rich off punishment.
We are America's leader in partnership corrections. We are CCA.
And so through ALEC, CCA had a hand in shaping crime policy across the country, including not just prison privatization, but the rapid increase in criminalization.
I think this accusation that, quite frankly, is just false, that somehow Alec was in favor of imprisoning a bunch of people for because of private prisons. I think that's just, unfortunately, one of these attack-type tactics they do on Alec.
Alec pushed forward a number of policies to increase the number of people in prison and to increase the sentences of people who are in prison.
I'm trying to think how to address it. It's hard to address something that's, like, basically, almost like folklore at this point.
They are not doing anything to really clean up that past or to address the real consequences for real people of the extreme policies they pushed. In fact, it doesn't even talk about its past history.
I mean, it's hard for me to even understand what they're even talking about. A lot of it.
CCA directly profited from its investment in ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the American people in many ways were harmed by these policies due to the mass incarceration of people, particularly people of color.
Look, right now our position is that we want less people in prison. I don't think that helps the private prison industry, quite frankly. I think myself and the lawmakers, we're just always looking for better, innovative ways to run government. And I think that's one thing as conservatives, those who believe in the free market and limited government, we pride ourselves on. We're supposed to be the party of innovation.
Another bill that Alec innovated was SB 1070. CCA was on the Alec task force that pushed that law that gave police the right to stop anyone they thought looked like an immigrant. This law filled immigration detention facilities, and it directly benefited an ALEC member, CCA.
CCA could potentially reap huge financial benefits from SB 1070, since 1070 was designed to lock up a lot more people in Arizona on federal immigration charges. Cha-ching!
An influx of undocumented immigrants, many of them children, has crammed...
In Arizona, Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA, holds the federal contract to house detained immigrants. It's worth more than $11 million every month.
Pat Nolan.
Our immigration facilities are a disgrace. Their families kept there in horrible conditions.
They're called detention facilities, but they're really prisons for immigrants. That you call them a detention facility doesn't make them not a prison. They are a prison, they just have a different name.
We're having what some people are saying is a creation of a crimmigration system, that there's the merger of our immigration enforcement and our law enforcement system. And so that some of the same things that were used in the war on drugs are now migrating to other populations.
You heard it with Donald Trump, not about blacks, but with Mexicans. They're rapists, murderers. And by the way, some of them may be good people. Oh boy, where do you start on something like that?
In late 2010, CCA left ALEC after a big NPR story came out accusing ALEC of pushing SB 1070.
ALEC doesn't do anything on immigration. No which way, not to the right, not to the left, nothing. So I don't really have anything for you on that one, sorry.
ALEC has recently made what I would describe as a PR move to say that it's going to be right on crime, that it's going to be on the right side of criminal justice policy and reform. That move comes in the wake of its loss of a massive number of corporations.
What ultimately happened is our board looked at the issues that ALEC worked on and decided that we don't do social issues. We are focused on economic issues. We jettisoned basically almost all of our legislation that was pre-2007. So we basically a fresh start going forward.
This industry knows that it's dying and is actually preparing for the next thing. And the animating factors that have led to a system like bail, we're always going to see new permutations of a cancer, right? And that's what this is.
And over the last couple of years, since 2008, we've been involved really in a wholesale reform effort where 31 states have now adopted positive changes on sentencing, on parole and probation reforms.
ALEC has a concerted effort to privatize almost every aspect of government, but we had no idea that they were also aiming to try to privatize probation and parole. ALEC is no longer concerned about CCA and CCA's interests. CCA no longer has a seat at the table with ALEC, so it doesn't have a financial interest in advancing policies that increase the profits of CCA. But the American Bail Coalition is still part of ALEC.
Today, our state penitentiaries are
filled to the brim and overflowing with inmates.
When I think of systems of oppression, historically in this country and elsewhere, they're durable and they tend to reinvent themselves, and they do it right under your nose.
One of the things they want to do is GPS monitoring.
Having a home confinement system for juveniles, I think, is a great thing because it forces the parents to take responsibility and step up.
Prisons would be more embedded in our homes.
Some of them be monitored on GPS and things like that.
So folks won't be locked up in a cage in a cell inside of an institution, but they will have ankle bracelets on. They have wrist bracelets on.
Would that help to solve the prison overcrowding problem? Absolutely.
And what I worry about is that we fall asleep at the wheel, wake up, and realize that we may not have people in prisons in rural communities all over America, but that we're incarcerating people right in their communities.
That is what I see, what a lot of the focus is on, is taking people from prison, putting them in community corrections, parole and probation, and really investing in those programs.
How much progress is it really if communities of color are still under perpetual surveillance and control, but now there's a private company making money off the GPS monitor rather than the person being locked in a literal cage?
If we can help you save crime victims in your legislative district, you don't mind me making a dollar.
And so Alec continues to be a body that, while it may have some really strong rhetoric on why it supports crime reform now, suddenly, sort of out of the blue, it actually has real financial interests.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
That was Jenny Watson.
If you're in the prison business, you don't want reform. You may say you do, but you don't.
And there are a bunch of people out there desperately trying to make sure that that prison population does not drop one person because their economic model needs that.
Prison industrial complex refers to the system of mass incarceration and companies that profit from mass incarceration. That includes both operators of private prisons, which get a lot of attention, as well as a vast sea of vendors.
From Securus Technologies that supplies telephone services that made $114 million in profits last year.
Those calls to family and friends are costing a pretty penny in state prisons.
They inflate the price that they charge the inmate and the inmate's family.
For example, in Maryland, if you earn minimum wage, you'd have to work an hour and a half to afford a 10-minute phone call.
An image of a woman inmate on a phone.
There's also Aramark, one of the big food service providers. In more than one state, they've been accused of having maggots in the food that they've served.
Headlines from Detroit, Michigan, Ohio.
Corizon Healthcare provides healthcare services in 28 different states, multi-million-dollar contracts for this service.
Huge incentives given to contractors for very long contracts, so it's actually a disincentive to provide this service because you're going to be paid anyway.
Dying alone, medical provider is sued in inmate's death. Healthcare contractor denied prisoners hernia operations.
One of the reasons it's so difficult to talk about mass incarceration in this country and to question it is because it has become so heavily monetized.
A little company called Unicor that does $900 million in business annually. How do they do it? Volume. Also, prison labor.
Partnerships between correctional industries and private business are a rapidly growing segment of a multi-billion dollar industry in America.
We talk about sweatshops and we beat our fists at people overseas for exploiting poor free labor, but we don't look that it's happening right here at home every day. You have corporations who are now investing in this free labor.
It's all over. It's from sports, uniforms, hats, Microsoft, Boeing. Federal inmates are making the guidance systems for the Patriot missile system. JCPenney jeans made in Tennessee. Victoria's Secret. Anderson flooring, wood products are made in Georgia. It's always been Idaho potatoes. They're planted, grown, harvested, packed, and shipped by inmates.
Victoria's Secret and JCPenney switched suppliers once their ties came to light. Simply put, corporations are operating in prisons and profiting from punishment.
Journalist Bob Sloan.
Prison industries have gotten so big that it's very difficult now to try and do away with them. Too much money out there, too many lawmakers that support it because they're being lobbied. So the public's got to stand up and take it back. it'll never get done if they don't.
Criminal by the Roots.
What it is, and that's how it go. Get treated like a criminal if crime is all you know. Get greeted like a nigga if the niggas all you show. A public enemy to send an eye in the scope.
A female reporter.
On the night of his arrest, Khalif Browder was walking home from a party with his friends in the Bronx when he was stopped by police.
Shaka Sengor, then Khalif.
Khalif was charged with a crime, a really petty crime, that it turns out he didn't commit.
Then they said, we're going to take you to the precinct, and most likely we're going to let you go home. And then I never went home.
They told you that you could post bail.
Yes, that's correct.
$10,000.
Yes.
And of course,
I couldn't make that. My family couldn't pay it.
There are thousands of people in jails right this moment that are sitting there for no other reason than because they're too poor to get out.
We have a criminal justice system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, shapes outcomes.
And I think what most Americans think of, because they've watched so many courtroom dramas and things like that, they think that criminal justice system is about judges and juries. Well, that's really stopped being the case.
The system simply cannot exist if everyone decides to go to trial.
Everybody insisted on a trial, the whole system would shut down.
What typically happens is the prosecutor says, you know, you can make a deal and we'll give you 3 years, or you can go to trial and we'll get you 30. So you want to take that chance? Feel free.
Nobody in the hood goes to trial.
97% of those people who were locked up have plea bargain. And that is one of the worst violations of human rights that you can imagine in the United States.
You have in this country people pleading guilty to crimes they didn't commit, just because the thought of going to jail for what the mandatory minimums are is so excruciating.
Khalif Browder decided, I'm not going to take the plea.
So you had to choose between being in prison for up to 15 years and going home right then by admitting you did a crime you didn't do.
I felt like I was done wrong. I felt like something needed to be done about this. I felt like something needs to be said. If I just cop out and say that I did it, nothing's going to be done about it. I didn't do it. No justice is served.
What you're not taught is that if you exercise that right to a trial and you are convicted, we will punish you more.
The courts basically punished him for having the audacity to not take a plea deal and to want to take it to trial. And in that time, in those 3 years that he was sitting there and not being charged for anything, that's when the mental health issues started to deteriorate. He started to get into fights.
Blurred images of a struggle.
After a while, I just kept hearing the same thing from the whole 3 years, and I just learned to cope with just being in there, and that was rough. I already knew. After a while, I just gave up hope.
He's shut in a small room. Two inmates kick their way in, followed by two guards who pull them off Khalif. Other inmates enter.
3 years on Rikers Island, two of that in solitary confinement. And he was a child, a baby.
You miss everything. Everything about being home, the fresh air, your family, certain events. You want to be home. And then when they give you an offer to go home right then and there, it's like, I want to go home, but then you know you didn't do it, so you don't want to take the plea and say that you do it. It's not right.
He's led along a walkway by a guard who suddenly shoves him in the back, then throws him to the floor.
I was scared all day because I didn't know where it would come from. I don't know where any harm would come.
Khalif suffered through so many beatings, both by the people he was locked up with and the guards, he ended up attempting suicide on several occasions. After almost 3 years in jail waiting his trial, they dropped all the charges and he was set free.
Two more guards rushed to the walkway.
He spent 2 years in an environment that people have argued is designed to break you within 30 days.
I mean, I can't really tell you what's next, but this happens every day.
2 years after his release from jail, Khalif Browder hanged himself at his home in the Bronx.
Two photographs of him, a young man with bags under his eyes and a pencil mustache.
He was 22 years old.
A previous picture before his arrest was that of a smiling teenager with bright, sparkling eyes and an infectious smile. A later picture shows the exact opposite. Khalif Browder, in an interview with ABC News.
If I would have just been pled guilty, then my story would have never been heard. Nobody would have took the time to listen to me. I'd have been just another criminal.
Lisa Jesse Peterson.
Prison industrial complex, the system, the industry, it is a beast. It eats Black and Latino people for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
More prison footage.
We didn't even think about who gets the jobs of spending time with these folks. Otherwise, we'd want social workers and teachers. We'd want people with understanding of human behavior. And we do the opposite.
A prisoner slithers snake-like past a German shepherd. A naked man is turned over onto his back.
You immediately become numb. I think that's what jail does to humans. That immediate dehumanization and sensory deprivation that nobody could really understand unless they lived through it.
Prisoners in tiny cells.
So the last 14 years, my son has not had any human contact other than to be handcuffed by an officer. He doesn't even have a window in his cell, and that's one thing that really disturbs me. It troubles me. I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that we would even have such an architectural design in our country. I never realized that there was prison cells built like that.
Human beings are not born to be locked up and encaged.
Most people wouldn't keep their pets in the kind of conditions that we keep people in.
Prisons and jails have become warehouses in the sense that where we've moved as a society is that it's not enough to just deprive you of your liberty, but we want to punish you too.
Most of the society don't understand what it means to be behind those big gates in those barbed wires.
A helicopter flies over the prison complex. Prisoners out in the open.
Once somebody is arrested and convicted, they're gone. Nobody particularly cares about them.
David Keene.
In many ways, the prison system are sort of in the dark.
So it makes it a lot easier, you know, cognitively and emotionally. It makes it a lot easier to say, send people there.
If you look at the whole problem, you say, what are we doing? We have too many laws locking too many people up for too many things, giving them sentences that are too harsh, putting them in prison, and while they're in prison, doing very little, if anything, to rehabilitate them so that they can re-enter civil society when they get out. And then when they get out, we shun them.
Over 40,000 collateral consequences for people that come through our criminal justice system.
It's that question, have you been convicted of a felony that appears on the job application?
In some cases can affect your access to student loans.
They can't get many business licenses, food stamps if they're hungry.
Private rentals in regards to housing. It's that question that appears on life insurance.
The scarlet letter follows you for the rest of your life in this country.
In March of 2015, we had tens of thousands of people come to Selma to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the crossing of the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And very few of those people realized that nearly 30% of the Black male population of Alabama today has permanently lost the right to vote as a result of a criminal conviction.
President Obama's there.
If you do something wrong, you should pay it back and then move forward with your life. But yet in America, there's absolutely zero closure. We actually tell American citizens when they pay back their debt to society, their citizenship will still be denied from them.
So many aspects of the old Jim Crow are suddenly legal again once you've been branded a felon. And so it seems that in America, we haven't so much ended racial caste, but simply redesigned it.
Usher with Change.
We are now in an era where Democrats and Republicans alike have decided that it's not in their interests anymore to maintain the prison system as it is.
Now, all of a sudden, Hillary Clinton is meeting with Black Lives Matter activists and talking about it.
It's time to change our approach and end the era of mass incarceration.
She's made a major address on it.
We will reform our criminal justice system from end to end and rebuild trust between law enforcement and the communities they serve.
President Obama going to prison, you know, as the first sitting president to ever visit a prison.
We've got an opportunity to make a difference at a time when overall violent crime rates have been dropping,
at the same time as incarcerations last year dropped for the first time in 40 years.
And conservatives, who were always seen or understood within the narrative as being the tough on crime ones, have now embraced justice reform. It's very man bites dog.
You see, Texas used to spend billions locking people up for minor offenses. We shifted our focus to diversionary programs like community supervision.
We gotta ask ourselves, do we feel comfortable with people taking the lead of a conversation in a moment where it feels right politically?
Historically, when one looks at efforts to create reforms, they inevitably lead to more repression.
And so if we leave it up to them, what they're going to do is they're going to tinker with the system. They're not going to do the sort of change that we need to see as a country to get us out of this mess. And they're certainly not going to go backwards and fix the mess that they've made, because they're not ready to make that admission. But as a country, I don't think we've ever been ready to make the admission that we have steamrolled through entire communities and multiple generations, when you think about things like slavery and Jim Crow and all the other systems of oppression that have led us to where we are today.
Donald Trump.
So much fun. I love it. I love it. We having a good time. USA. USA.
He smiles and looks around his appreciative supporters. There are a couple of black people being hustled out.
Knock the crap out of him, would you? Seriously.
Like the African-American man in a suit being manhandled, so is a woman at the rally.
In the good old days, this doesn't happen because they used to treat them very, very rough. And when they protested once, you know, they would not do it again so easily.
Like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
Grainy footage of a man being punched. People are being hustled out at the Trump rally.
I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks. That's true.
Knocking hell out of that big mouth. The next time we see him, we might have to kill him.
In the good old days, they'd rip him out of that seat so fast.
Images match what he's saying.
Shut up!
The fuck not.
Shut the hell up!
Now I would not shut the hell up.
Old and new footage mirror each other.
In the good old days, law enforcement acted a lot quicker than this. A lot quicker.
And we're going to enforce the law, and Americans should remember that if we're going to have law.
I am the law and order candidate.
Placards, Black Lives Matter.
We thought, I mean, they called the end of slavery Jubilee. We thought we were done then. And then you had 100 years of Jim Crow terror and lynching. Dr. King, these guys come on the scene, Ella Jo Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer. We get the bills passed to vote, and then they break out the handcuffs. Label you felon, you can't vote or get a job. So we don't know what the next iteration of this will be, but it will be. It will be. And we will have to be vigilant.
I'm a prison cell, 6x9, living hell, stone wall, metal bars for the guards in jail. My nickname, the can, the slammer, the big house. I'm the place many fear, cause there's no way out.
That was Nas with Last Words. Lifetime likelihood of imprisonment, white men, 1 in 17. A white silhouette of 17 men, and only one changes to have horizontal stripes on it.
The Bureau of Justice reported that 1 in 3 young black males is expected to go to jail or prison during his lifetime, which is an unbelievably shocking statistic.
The image of 1 in 3 fades, and a new image springs up to take its place.
Black men account for roughly 6.5% of the U.S. population. They make up 40.2% of the prison population.
Democratic Senator Cory Booker, New Jersey.
We now have more African Americans under criminal supervision than all the slaves back in the 1850s.
The prison industrial complex relies historically on the inheritances of slavery.
Chaka Sengor again.
The 13th Amendment says no involuntary servitude except for those who have been duly convicted of a crime. So once you've been convicted of a crime, you are in essence a slave of the state.
Professor Kevin Gannon.
The stroke of a pen is not self-enforcing. And so while the 13th Amendment is hailed as this great milestone for freedom and abolitionists celebrate, and you know this is the end of a lifelong quest, the reality is much more problematic. Well, once that clause is inserted in there, it becomes a tool. It's there. It's embedded in the structure. And for those who seek to use this criminality clause as a tool, it can become a pretty powerful one because it's privileged. It's in the Constitution. It's the supreme law of the land.
Michelle Alexander.
Throughout American history, African Americans have repeatedly been controlled through systems of racial and social control that appear to die, but then are reborn in new form tailored to the needs and constraints of the time. You know, after the collapse of slavery, a new system was born, convict leasing, which was a new form of slavery. And once convict leasing faded away, a new system was born, a Jim Crow system that relegated African Americans to a permanent second-class status. And here we are, decades after the collapse of the old Jim Crow, and a new system has been born again in America, a system of mass incarceration that once again strips millions of poor people, overwhelmingly poor people of color, of the very rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement.
And so instead of talking about it, we just tried to move on. After the Civil Rights Act was passed and after the civil rights laws, we tried to play it off. And because we didn't deal with it, that narrative of racial difference continued. And it turned into this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that follows every black and brown person wherever they are.
Protests in Ferguson, Missouri.
Ferguson was not simply about Mike Brown. It was also this pattern of mass criminalization and mass incarceration. There was an average of 3 warrants per household in Ferguson. And so people rose up because they understood that they were also enemies of the state, seen as enemies of the state.
Melina Abdallah.
The communities in which black people live are really become occupied territories, and black people have become seen as enemy combatants, right, who don't have any rights and who can be stopped and frisked and, you know, arrested and detained and questioned and killed with impunity.
Melina is chair of Pan-African Studies, California State University, Los Angeles. Jelani Cobb.
We were to look at the largest scale riots that we know of in our recent history, from Rodney King to the Detroit riot in 1967, the Newark riot in 1967, Harlem riot in 1964, Watts in 1965. Every single one of those riots was a result of police brutality. That is the common thread.
It would be a mistake to say, as many people do in the current context, that, oh, if you're against the police, then you're against law and order, and these are hardworking civil servants, they're putting their lives on the line for you every day. And, you know, that's true. People who join the police do so, you know, to do these sorts of things. But if you dismiss black complaints of mistreatment by police as being completely rooted in our modern context, then you're missing the point completely. There has never been a period in our history where the law and order branch of the state has not operated against the freedoms, the liberties, the options, the choices that have been available for the black community, generally speaking. And to ignore that racial heritage, to ignore that historical context, means that you can't have an informed debate about the current state of blacks and police relationship today, because this didn't just appear out of nothing. This is the product of a centuries-long historical process, and to not reckon with that is to shut off solutions.
We may have lost the sheets of the Ku Klux Klan, but clearly when you see black kids being shot down, then obviously we didn't cut out this cancer.
Corey Green, co-founder Holla.
For many of us, you know, who families live through this, who are extensions of this kind of oppression, we don't need to see pictures to understand what's going on. is really to kind of like speak to the masses who've been ignoring this for the majority of their life. But I also think there's trouble of just showing, you know, black bodies as dead bodies too. It's too much of anything becomes unhealthy, unuseful.
Gina Clayton.
I think they need to be seen if the family is okay with it. It wasn't until things were made visual in the civil rights movement that we really saw folks come out and being shocked into movement.
You have to shock people into paying attention.
But there's a kind of historical trajectory that we can trace here through media and technology. We went back to the slavery era where people were writing autobiographies of slave narratives.
Like My Freedom.
Later in the 19th century, when people began to use photographs and they showed images.
A photograph.
There's a famous image of Slave Gordon and his back, and you can see just this kind of lattice of scar tissue that is evidence of the whippings that he received. Or the images of lynchings, which white people produced.
Michelle Alexander.
The murder of Emmett Till was really thought of as being one of the primary catalysts for the civil rights movement. The willingness of his mother to have an open casket funeral.
Mamie Till is escorted into the church.
Hundreds and hundreds of black folks filed past and see this young boy who had been killed by a white supremacist in the South. To publish those photographs in black publications so the entire black world, like our Facebook or our Twitter now, right, so that the whole black world could see what had happened.
In the 1950s, Dr. King and the civil rights movement used television in this way. Look, this is what segregation looks like. These are dogs attacking children. These are people being fire hosed. Searching for the medium of technology that will confirm your experience such that your basic humanity can be recognized.
The difference now is somebody can hold up one of these, get what's going on, they can put it on YouTube, and the whole world has to deal with it. That's what's new. It's not the protest, it's not the brutality, it's the fact that we can force a conversation about it.
We have been consistently being murdered as a result of police aggression. They generally would excuse it by calling us criminals when they was killing Oscar Grant.
With permission of Oscar Grant's family, cops stand over them.
When they got to Eric Gardner,
I can't breathe. With permission of Eric Garner's family, his head is being pressed to the ground.
I can't breathe. Everyone pointed out the fact that he was saying, I can't breathe. But the sentences before that were, why are you always stopping me? Why is it day in and day out, week in and week out, you're stopping me? And that, I think, is hugely important.
When we think about the children who were killed at the hands of the state. I think about Tamir Rice at 12 years old and the way that he was killed, you know, it hits my heart.
Film was shown with permission of Tamir Rice's family, as was that of Sam Du Bois. Two further killings shown with permission from the families of Freddie Gray and Jason Harrison. Laquan McDonald being shot on the street was shown with the family's permission.
Roll on your stomach now.
And with permission of Eric Courtney Harris's family.
Oh, he shot me, man. Oh, my God.
You didn't do shit. You hear me?
I'm losing my breath. Fuck your breath.
Stay with me. We got pulled over for a busted tail light in the back.
Philando Castile is slumped behind the driver's wheel, filmed with permission of his family. Names of those killed include Brian Acton, 40, 4, 1815, Columbia. Philando Castile, 7616, Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Ariel Clark, 31, 02, 2016, Lancaster, Ohio. The list goes on. Michelle Alexander.
Police violence, that isn't the problem in and of itself. It's reflection of a much larger, brutal system of racial and social control known as mass incarceration, which authorizes this kind of police violence.
That's why, for me, the brilliance of Black Lives Matter, to have a distributed leadership model, you can't find their address. I mean, Black Lives Matter is not a stoppable phenomenon. by a bullet or anything else. And so there's hope there because of that.
Having people truly understand that when Black lives matter, everybody's life matters, including every single person that enters this criminal justice system and this prison industrial complex. It's not just even about only Black lives, right? It's about changing the way this country understands human dignity.
Photographs. Hash Blackspring. Justice for Jahar. Alton Sterling. Philando Castile. Hash Say Their Names. Black Lives Matter.
That's what really this Black Lives Matter moment is about. This question of whose life do we recognize as valuable?
A man holds a placard, Am I Next? A protest outside Macy's. A banner reads, Hold Police Accountable. End Racism. Justice for Mike Brown, Seattle. A placard, Silence is Violence.
The opposite of criminalization is humanization. That's the one thing I hope that people will understand.
It's about rehumanizing us as a people and us, right, as a people, all of us.
More placards and banners. I am a man. Hands up, I can't breathe. Don't shoot. No more killing. No more hate. No more of this police state.
The system of mass incarceration has grown and sprawled and developed an appetite that is gobbling up people and communities of all colors. But if it hadn't been for the fact that it began with a group of people defined by race that we as a nation have learned not to care about, we wouldn't be talking about 2 million people behind bars today.
People say all the time, well, I don't understand how people could have tolerated slavery. How could they have made peace with that? How could people have gone to a lynching and participated in that? How did people make sense of this segregation, this white and colored only drinking? That's so crazy. If I was living at that time, I would have never tolerated anything like that. And the truth is, we are living at this time, and we are tolerating it.
The screen fades to black. Directed by Ava DuVernay.
Southern leaves, southern trees we hung from. Barren souls, heroic songs unsung. Forgive them, Father, they know this knot is undone. Tied with the rope that my grandmother died. Pride of the pilgrims affect lives of millions. In slave days, separating fathers from children. Institution ain't just a building, but a method of having Black and brown bodies fill them. We ain't seen as human beings with feelings. Will the U.S. ever be us, Lord willing? For now we know the new Jim Crow. To stop, search, and arrest our souls. Police and policies patrol. Philosophies of control. A cruel hand taking hold. We let go to free them so we can free us. America's moment to come to Jesus. Bird sings for freedom to ring. Black bodies being lost in the American dream. Blood a black bean, a pastoral scene. Slavery still alive, check Amendment 13. Not whips and chains, our subliminal. Instead of nigger, they use the word criminal. Sweet land of liberty, incarcerated country. Shot me with your ray gun and now you wanna trump me. Prison is a business, America's the company. Investing in the justice, fear and long suffering. We staring in the face of hate again. The same hate they say will make America great again. No consolation prize for the dehumanized. For America to rise is a matter of black lives. And we gon' free them so we can free us. America's moment to come to Jesus.
Copyright 2016, Netflix Studios, LLC, all rights reserved. Letters pop out from a white background, then turn red. Netflix.